Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch store over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop, hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. And if you're interested, you can just look for a link in the show description. But as for today, my guest is Roshira Castaneda, who is a freshwater ecologist particularly interested in endangered and invasive species. She is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Great Lakes Laboratory for Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences at Fisheries and Oceans Canada. She completed her BSc and her MSc at McGill University, where she studied the population dynamics of an invasive bivalve, the Asian clam, in the St. Lawrence River. She went on to complete her PhD at the University of Toronto. Roshira's PhD research was focused on developing the use of underwater cameras to detect and quantify rare freshwater fishes, and she did her fieldwork in water bodies in Ontario, Canada, as well as multiple provinces in South Africa. Her current research is focused on threats and recovery of imperiled freshwater species and the ecology and impacts of invasive species. She serves as an associate editor for the journal Biological Invasions, and aside from her research, she is passionate about creating inclusive and diverse spaces and has volunteered on several committees and for nonprofit organizations that promote and take action on increasing equity, diversity, and inclusion in STEM. Without further ado, welcome to the Fisheries Podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you've done some extensive research across Canada and different water bodies throughout Canada. Would you say that Canada is home for you now?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I grew up in Montreal, born and raised in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, along the St. Lawrence River. The Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River are definitely my favorite places to study.
Is the St. Lawrence, would you say, growing up, that was somewhere you visited or vacationed around that water body that sort of got you thinking about it more and have a soft spot for it or something?
So I grew up maybe 20 minutes from the St. Lawrence River. I mean, Montreal's an island, so it's surrounded by water, and the main water body is the St. Lawrence River. So there's a big, beautiful old port in Montreal, which, you know, you can see the whole river. It's gorgeous. So growing up, definitely going down to the water and just seeing this massive river was always very inspiring. But I didn't really get into freshwater ecology until my master's. Growing up, I always wanted to be that marine biologist that you see on TV, which I think is probably a pretty, you know, common thing to want to be when you're growing up. So I was always more interested in marine biology, and I did a field course in the Bay of Fundy in high school, and that really solidified my love for ecology and biology. But then, you know, being at McGill University, there was a freshwater invertebrate course, and I really enjoyed taking that class. I had no idea there were so many little critters and bugs living just beneath rocks, right, you know, in my backyard. Sure. So that really got me into freshwater ecology, and that's when I did my master's there with Professor Anthony Ricciardi at McGill studying bivalves.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's kind of how I got my start in freshwater systems too. There was a PhD candidate at Clemson who I worked with on an undergrad research project, and he approached me and he said, "Do you need a job this summer?" And I didn't hesitate. I said, "Yeah, I need a job this summer." I didn't even ask what we'd be doing, but he was studying macroinvertebrate populations and assemblages and how they differed across different water bodies in South Carolina. And so, you know, my first couple of years and internships, you know, that led to a fisheries, I guess, career at this point, you know, were stream restoration and macroinvertebrate focus. So that's pretty neat.
Inverts are still my first true love. But now I study fishes mostly.
Right. So I feel like every invasive species has an invasion history or a rich story. What would you say the story for the Asian clam in the St. Lawrence River is, or maybe just Quebec in general?
Yeah, so the Asian clam was in Quebec. It no longer is. It was extirpated. So what's interesting about this clam is it's native to subtropical Asia. So it always considered a more warm water species. It invaded in the States and probably like coast of BC, British Columbia, Canada. There was a specimen found there in the 1930s. It was found in a record of a museum in the museum collections. But it's pretty widespread in the US. And there's been some experiments done back in the 70s showing that the Asian clam couldn't survive 2 degrees Celsius. So there was no thought, at least, of a risk to the Asian clam invasion to Canada generally, because our waters are much colder. But weirdly enough, they are in Canada, in the Great Lakes, at least in some small patches where there is anthropogenic thermal changes to the environment. So at least for most of the time, it's power plants that release their hot waters that cool their systems into natural water bodies. So it creates this kind of artificial microhabitat that is almost subtropical. So at least for the St. Lawrence River, the Asian clam was found in the thermal plume of the nuclear power plant that used to be operational on the St. Lawrence River. So it created this plume of hot water discharge. So in the winter, it actually remained around 10 degrees Celsius, whereas it usually would be much colder, at least freeze over where there was very little current. And so this little microhabitat of heated water basically enabled the Asian clam to establish and persist. And as I said, it's extirpated now because after the disaster at Fukushima, the Quebec government decided that they nuclear power plants were too risky. So they shut down the power plant in 2013, and the Asian clam subsequently died off.
Oh.
So that's the story of the Asian clam in the St. Lawrence River. So they were here, they were found in 2009, and they were pretty much extirpated by 2013 once the power plant was shut down.
Wow. That's pretty unique in that a lot of times I feel like some of those invasion histories are still writing more to the story, unfortunately. You know, they're expanding their range. But that's a pretty unique example of it wasn't necessarily the scientists saying, okay, we should shut this power plant down so that this this clam doesn't have any habitat. But it sort of just worked out in the end, I suppose. Maybe not for the people working at the plant.
But that is true. I think it was a big employer of the area. But yeah, so actually what's interesting is that there are overwintering populations in cold waters in New York State. So Lake George has a huge population clam, and that water gets below 2 degrees Celsius. So we were also worried that maybe we could have had that kind of genotype in the St. Lawrence River that would survive, but it didn't.
Okay. So what are some of the negative effects that they were worried about for the St. Lawrence system, or maybe some negative effects that they've seen elsewhere that made this species particularly invasive, or made it something that people had on their radar as something to look out for?
Yeah, so the Asian clam specifically is, I think, one of the top 100 global invaders or something. It made one of those lists. Mm-hmm. So Asian clam are able to sexually and asexually reproduce. So that makes them great invaders. You don't have a handful of them, or even just maybe one, to start reproducing and populating an area. But they're also filter feeders and pedal feeders, so which means they feed from the water column, but they also use their foot and eat detritus from the sediment. And so they're kind of removing those nutrients or energy from both the water column and the sediment, which obviously changes the environment. And they get really a really, really high abundance, and they go through these boom-bust cycles. So because they're such heavy filter feeders, they feed from the sediment, they also accumulate a lot of contamination, and they bioaccumulate any contamination that might be in the water. And so when they go through these boom bust cycles, they'll do massive die-offs and then release all these contaminants, right? So that could have adverse effects to the rest of the ecosystem. But one, I think, popular case study of Asian clam impacts that, you know, went through several food webs or went throughout the food web was in the Potomac River. So when Asian clam, you know, were established, their filter feeding cleared the water column from any, you know, turbidity, which increased the growth of an invasive algae or macrophyte. I forget which one, I think probably Mariophyllum, but that created habitat for smallmouth bass, which I don't believe was native. And then it created these huge smallmouth bass fishery contests. So it's kind of like this, from just like this one invasion, this explosion of another invader, so facilitating the macrophytes, which then facilitated increase in smallmouth bass abundance. So that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, that's like the quintessential cascade that you read about in biology textbooks. That's super
exactly. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, I think we had, and maybe it was a different species of corbicula, but I'm pretty sure we had Asian clam in South Carolina, and we would commonly get it in our samples in that internship that I was mentioning, but I could be wrong.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Sure. So it's definitely widespread. Wow. I had no idea that it was, I had no idea that it was all the way up into.
Oh, it's everywhere. Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So you've done research, obviously, on a variety of different things, but I see that you've also done and published some papers on microplastic pollution. How did you get your start in these projects?
So that actually stems from the Asian clam project. So sampling for Asian clams in the St. Lawrence River, obviously it's a deep river and very channelized, but so we would have to go out on a boat and using an instrument called petite ponar grabs, which I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with, we'd lower it down and take samples from the sediment, right? So that's how we collected our Asian clam. So then we would sieve these sediments with all the critters in them in the field, but then we bring them back into the lab and kind of like sort it all out under the microscope. So picking out Asian clam, other inverts. We also found a cryptogenic species that has never been found in the St. Lawrence River before, a little entoprot, which is pretty cool. But in those samples as well, I was noticing these little beads. We had no idea what they were. So we kind of just saved those samples, put them aside. You know, as a master's student, you need to focus on your research and get your data and finish. So, but I always had this little inkling that there was something weird with these beads and we had no idea what they were. So I kept those samples aside for a future, maybe if I had time, project. And then Professor Ricciardi had organized this big environmental seminar conference at McGill and had invited Dr. Boris Worm from Dalhousie University, who's a fisheries biologist. And he was giving his presentation about, you know, collapse of fishes and the oceans and all that jazz. And his last slide was like, oh, and there's this emerging pollutant that an undergrad had brought up that I had never heard of, but it's called microplastics. And so he starts like putting up these images of microbeads and microplastics, and it just clicked. And this was like 2 years after I had collected my samples, like that is exactly what we have in our samples. So I went back to the lab later that week and I resorted all my samples. And then lo and behold, like everything that I had saved was these microplastic beads. So I brought it up to my professor and being like, listen, we also have these, the microplastic pollution isn't just in our oceans. We actually found, I found them in my sediment samples. So we kind of got excited about that. We sent them to a chem lab at McGill to identify what type of plastic it could be, if it was actually plastic and not something else. Ended up being polyethylene. So we decided to see if these microplastic beads were just concentrated in that thermal effluent in the sediments over there or across the St. Lawrence River. So we kind of sampled across the river and found them pretty much everywhere. And that was the study. So we just showed that microplastics were abundant in the sediments of the St. Lawrence River.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. Probably going to have to be a lot more research done in that area in the future, as I don't see anywhere close to being done with our dependency on single-use plastics.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. Yeah, microplastics field has blown up. It's huge. And there's a few labs here at UofT, University of Toronto, that also study microplastics. And okay. Yeah, it's an emerging threat, that's for sure.
So what is Expedition and how did you become involved with it?
Expedition was is an all woman led crew of citizen scientists and scientists who go out sailing the oceans and collecting microplastic information. They do this all over the world. I don't know if they have one right now, but it's really to collect information on the distribution of microplastics and plastics in general in the oceans and also raise awareness. And so when the two organizers for the expedition in the Great Lakes had approached a whole bunch of different scientists studying microplastics pollution because they also wanted to raise awareness in the Great Lakes and freshwater systems, since Expedition was mainly focused in marine ecosystems. So I teamed up with them. I was their science lead for the sailing boat that went out in Lake Ontario to collect microplastics, send them off for analysis, but also use that as a science communication opportunity.
That's amazing. So. That sounds so epic. You know, like, oh, you know, we just sail around the world looking for microplastics. No big deal.
I know. It's amazing. It's actually my first time on a sailboat. So that was pretty exciting.
That's cool. Yeah. I've never been on one. So I guess I'll have to put that on the bucket list too.
Yeah. First and only time.
So your recent paper titled Occupancy Dynamics of Rare Cyprinids After Invasive Fish Eradication is definitely on my short list of papers to read because it reminds me of a bunch of papers that I tried to read to help me write different parts of my own thesis involving introduced brown trout and, you know, native non-game species in northeastern Iowa. So in this case, what species were the invaders, or maybe just one invader, and what were the native species that you were trying to help or study?
So this study was done in a South African stream called the Rondehout River. And so this was a long-term data set that has been collected by my former co-supervisor, Dr. Olaf Feil. And this is kind of one of his main study rivers. So the Rondehout River is a tributary to one of the main dams in the area that, you know, provides water for irrigation and drinking. So actually the dam itself had been stocked with smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, bluegill, probably common carp. So a bunch of invasive fishes were stocked in the dam. And this is mostly for recreational fishing. That's a big thing in South Africa, as it is in okay. North America. And I think for food as well. But there were some natural barriers and an artificial, like, weir that was put into the river. And tilapia as well was stocked. But unfortunately, most of these invasive fishes had migrated upstream into the river, where there were some endemic fishes of South Africa there. And so once that kind of invaded, so anywhere these invaders are in the river itself, we basically don't have any native fishes, except for the Klein William yellowfish is the only one that is able to survive with smallmouth bass present. So the study was really focusing on smallmouth bass because smallmouth bass has had strong negative impacts on native fishes in South Africa, either eating young, outcompeting them. So it's a widespread problem throughout all of South Africa. But what's interesting about this river is that it's quite small. And so it was kind of an experimental river to see what would happen if we were able to eradicate these invasive species, what would happen to the native populations. And so Olaf's team basically, with, you know, all the permits and protocols in place, used Rotenone, which is a kind of like a fish poison that kills off all the fish. from a river, including this invasive smallmouth bass, and then allow the river to repopulate naturally from upstream sources of the native fishes. And so this study that I did was looking at how the occupancy, so how the three different native fishes that we were looking at changed their occupancy across and the distribution and abundance across this river after the eradication of smallmouth bass. And what we found was that two of the threatened species, or the IUCN listed threatened species, pretty much bounced back to the same densities as the control regions upstream where there were no smallmouth bass. Wow. And then the endangered one, I believe that's the fiery redfin, is still a little unstable. They're still kind of like, I think, trying to get to that equilibrium of across the stream. So basically probably more restoration stuff needs to happen there because it's also a big agricultural area. So A lot of the riparian veg has been removed. So,
right. Well, at least that's promising that, you know, something, I mean, which is not always simple, but something as simple as just removing the species that weren't originally there caused, you know, the response that you would hope for. So, you know, I guess that is a step in the right direction for conservation moving forward of those fishes.
Yeah, and that's really just three of the fishes, though. So I think two had been completely extirpated. So unless there's some sort of stock population that we can use to reintroduce, like, it's not going to happen. But yeah, right. It's a success story for sure. And we were only able to do this because it's a long-term monitoring program. So Olaf and his team go back every year and do snorkel and camera surveys. So that's why we're able to actually disentangle these patterns of occupancy across the river.
Nice. So were you able to travel with them and help with the fieldwork portion in South Africa?
Yes. So I didn't do specific fieldwork for this paper, but I had visited the river. I was familiar with it. I was back there in 2019, so last winter, for the winter semester, and I helped another student there who was doing more studies on the river, collecting inverts. I think he's doing food web dynamics as well, doing snorkel surveys and stuff. So yeah, definitely got to go there. It's wonderful.
That's so cool. It's like in my mind, that's how all the movies are, you know, where they recruit the world's like leading experts and they fly them out to solve this problem. And typically, no matter what they have to say, they ignore them anyway and just do whatever they were going to do. But that's so cool that you had to travel to conduct research.
It's an incredible experience. And I'm really thankful for, you know, the group there, the South African Institute for Aquatic Biodiversity. They're really welcoming. They're so full of knowledge. I learned so much from them. And hopefully I was able to contribute a little bit to their long-term monitoring as well. It's a great collaboration.
That's cool. So how would you describe your current research and the direction that you're trying to take it? You know, what are some research questions that you're going to try and tackle?
So I'm currently working as a postdoctoral fellow for Fisheries and Oceans Canada. So that's the, you know, the federal government equivalent, I guess, is USGS. Okay. So my research now is a bit more focused on, so I'm in the species at risk group. So I'm working with endangered species. And what I'm currently working on is trying to figure out how we could correlate threats to actual population responses. So, you know, obviously we know urbanization causes species to decline in urban streams, but what exactly about urbanism is affecting, you know, the life history traits or other specific things of the population that causes it to decrease? So trying to make those mechanistic connections between the threat and the population decline. So most of this is literature, you know, reviews and systematic reviews and collecting, you know, data from a whole bunch of different resources. So no fieldwork, unfortunately, but also trying to classify threats specific to aquatic species. So really trying to get at the root of the problems for them. So that's my postdoctoral research. But I'm still working on a whole bunch of little side projects with collaborators on, you know, invasive species, trying to finish up and publish my last PhD chapter, which I haven't really gotten to. But yeah. So
well, there's time.
Much more focus. Yeah. Yeah. Much more focus on threats and then recovery of freshwater fishes and mussels.
And how long have you been at your current position, the postdoctoral?
Since January 15th. Okay. So I guess 8 months. Yeah.
Nice.
Brand new. Yeah, just defended in November last year.
Well, congrats.
Sorry, I graduated. I know it. Thank you.
Yeah, I just defended over the summer, and it's a great feeling.
It is. Congratulations to you, too.
I think it was weird to finish during the spring semester, you know, when every university was basically shutting down. But the one nice thing is that I needed to be writing anyway. And so it might have been good for office distractions.
So, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you could sift back through all the memories and cool fieldwork outings and pick maybe the most memorable, rewarding, difficult, crappy day, could you maybe pick a story and sort of describe what happened during that day? And feel free to think about this one for a minute if you need.
Yeah. So I guess one of the scarier things that had happened. Well, I wasn't scared at the moment. It was just thinking back on it, I was like, why wasn't I more scared? So we were in South Africa. We were studying the distribution of an invasive fish called tench, which hadn't really exploded in terms of population. They had been introduced many times by Europeans, or the British really, in like the early 1900s, and they hadn't really like established the spread. So our study was looking at where they are in this one town called Ceres, which is an agricultural town with lots of orchards. So I think, I don't know if you have them in the States, it's like a juice called Ceres. It's from that area. So they do a lot of fruit agriculture, and they have these irrigation ponds that they keep, you know, just in case there's a drought, and then they can use that as irrigation for their orchards. But they like to stock, the farmers like to stock these irrigation dams with species for fishing and stuff. So we were trying to figure out different ways we can sample tench, so eDNA cameras, fike nets, trying to compare all these different methods. So we drove up to one of the dams, and everyone gets out of the car or the truck, and they're talking to the farmer owner. And I open the door, and all of a sudden, there's this huge cobra, this Cape cobra, just like rises up and like hood out and just hissing at me. And I'm just sitting in the truck with the door open. And all I can think of for some silly reason is trying to reach back for my camera. And I'm like, this is so cool. There's a full-on Cape cobra staring at me. And then I was like, guys, don't come here. There's a cobra. And I'm trying to get their attention, and they're completely ignoring me because obviously you don't want to be rude. You want to talk to, you know, the landowners and be respectful. But I'm also like, there's a cobra. Like once I couldn't grab my camera, I'm like, okay, this is a dangerous situation. So I just like sat there very still, didn't move. And I'm like, it's going to go away. It just feels threatened. And it actually did. It just like slithered off. And then I got out of the car. I'm like, guys, here I am yelling for my life and no one's paying attention. And then I was like, it was so cool. This is what it looked like. And then the farmer, he went white. He just like ghostly, he's just like, oh my God, you're so lucky you didn't get bitten. And I was like, well, how bad could it be? And it's like, you'd be dead in 8 minutes, like had it bit you. And it just didn't occur to me. Yes. So then after I was like, oh, that's not good. So I guess that was, at the moment I wasn't scared. I was more super excited. But after that, I realized that, we have to be a lot more careful. We knew our hospital routes, but I don't think we had really realized.
Not 8 minutes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So I guess that was the scariest, but also one of the cooler.
I think that checks out. Yeah. I think that ranks up there.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. About the scariest thing I saw in Northeast Iowa during my field work was just plant species that could cause a like skin burns. Nothing crazy. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't giant really have any. That was parsnip. Something parsnip.
Oh yeah, well we have that as well.
Yeah, yeah. That stuff can get pretty nasty sometimes, but
yes. Yeah, we always have to look out for those.
No cool snakes. Maybe one or two here and there, but no venomous ones that I can recall. So this is probably the most serious question of the day here. Academics on Twitter who review papers often have words or phrases that they just can't handle. They hate them. They never want to see them again. Since you are an associate editor for Biological Invasions, do you have any pet peeves?
Good question. I definitely don't like utilize unless it's like you're using this method that isn't usually used for that. Then I'm okay with utilized. I probably use words that I don't even like.
It's such a specific question. I see it all the time on social media. Like people just go on these long threads of words or phrases they just never want to see in a paper again. It just makes me kind of chuckle. So
yeah, I saw someone writing unique as they didn't like, and I was like, I don't know, what's wrong with unique? I also don't like policing people's way of writing.
That's how I am.
It's like everyone has their own writing style. It's valuable. If we all wrote the same, use the same words, and it'd be even more boring.
Yeah.
So I guess my pet peeve is not trying to use general language. So just using just these fancy words that even I have to look up. Just, you know, write a story. Of course, we still need, you know, intro methods, discussion, results in discussion, but, you know, just good flow, good story, I think is probably the most ideal than super, super structured writing. But that's just a personal preference. I try not to judge or be super critical of writing per se.
So. Right. Yeah, I think I'm on a similar boat to you. There's no need to make it, you know, sound more complicated than it is. But at the same time, like people took, you know, English classes from different professors or grew up with different sort of like regional dialects or, you know, have different research backgrounds. And so to expect all papers to sort of follow these guidelines of, you know, trying to figure out what words people hate. It's just hard. You can only do so much as someone who's submitting and, you know, already worried that the thing's going to get rejected in the first place. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I just feel that, you know, everyone comes from different backgrounds and having that diversity in writing makes it more interesting. And we learn a lot more from each other that way. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
So can you describe your involvement with the Canadian Association for Girls in Science?
Yeah, so I was doing that throughout my PhD. I no longer volunteer for them, mostly because I had to focus on my writing for my PhD. And then when I wanted to, Corona hit and everything just came on to pause. But this was a group that I had coordinated in Toronto. So there is a national group and then there's like little chapters across Canada in different cities. Mm-hmm. So I coordinated the Toronto chapter. And this group is really focused on hands-on activities. So really getting the girls and any non-binary child, just getting their hands dirty in any field of STEM. So it went from coding to making slime to we took them out fishing, seining, identifying fish, just showing them that first they're already interested in STEM. So this whole misconception of girls are not as interested is not true. We just get discouraged out of it because of a lot of sexism and just like perceived gender differences, which are, and we get discouraged, right? So this group is really just focusing on you can do it. You don't have to like every aspect of STEM. You don't even have to like it. But if you do, you do belong. And these are the types of things that scientists do in the field, in the lab, and you're welcome to be here and you are capable of doing these types of things. So we try to bring the girls and the children into the labs of folks who do science to show them what kind of science is done, how data is collected, and yeah, that they can do it too. And if it's something that they're interested in, they can definitely pursue in when they're older. So
right.
It's trying to show that everyone can do any field in STEM and not to get discouraged.
Yeah, that's awesome.
In a safe, inclusive space. Yeah.
That's good. It's good that they, one, that they have it. And I'm sure they appreciated you who, you know, at the time, I think you said you were a PhD student, you know, a example right in front of them that, you know, these are things that you can do, you know, I'm doing it now. And if it interests you, you know, get after it and go get it. So that's super cool.
Yeah, it was really fun. Yeah, it was something I missed doing actually.
I'm sure. Well, I guess the tough part, or what we classify as the tough part of the interview, is over. And, you know, we have a couple of final questions that we ask all of our interviewees. And so we start pretty simple, but most people would say it's the most complex. What is your favorite fish?
Good question. Actually, I've heard you ask other people this, so I've been thinking about it a lot. And I would say I don't generally have a favorite fish. But I do have a spot in my heart for red side dace. It's an endangered species in Canada. One of my main chapters of my thesis was, studying red side dace. So they do have a little spot in my heart. They're really cool. They're small, leucistid. They jump out of the water to feed on terrestrial insects, which is rare for, you know, a minnow. But they are little fragile flowers and we have to care for them. So in that aspect, they're not as cool because they're so, you know, endangered. But yeah, I would say probably red side dace. And I
That's
love
awesome.
Long nose dace because they're so goofy looking.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote about my second research chapter in my thesis. Involved southern red-bellied dace and long-nosed dace. So I'm right there
cool.
with you. I'm a dace enthusiast for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Right.
So do you have a dream job or location? I know you've been in Canada for a while, but would there be anywhere else you'd like to live?
No, not necessarily. I think I would go wherever my dream job is. And I don't know if this is a standard thing, but ideally I'd love to become a professor, run my own lab, mentor students, do research, save the fish. So I think anywhere where I could do that work, I'd be happy in, and where also my partner could work.
Right.
Two body problems. Great. But yeah, I'm open to anywhere. That, you know, allows me to do the research that I want to do. I mean, I've done research in Central and South America, several countries in Africa. I haven't done any research in Europe, but I would definitely be in an institution in Europe if it allowed me to do the research that I want to do.
Nice.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, just make international collaborations and you can do work there either way.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head that listened to this episode, what would that be?
So generally our freshwater ecosystems are fragile. We have a lot of endangered species, a lot of species that just have intrinsic value that we should be conserving. Invasive species, you know, are modifying these habitats, outcompeting them. So hopefully a lot of your research is focused on improving these freshwater habitats. That's certainly what I'm trying to do. And hopefully that's in the back of everyone's mind when they're doing freshwater ecology.
Well, I really enjoyed chatting with you today and I appreciate you carving some time out of your weekend. But if people wanted to learn more about you or connect with you online or social media, where can they find you?
So I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @Roshira, very simple. Not many people have my weird name. So Twitter, I have a website, so RoshiraCastaneda.com, and I have, you know, my contact info there as well, if they're interested, and a list of stuff that I've done. And if anyone ever wants to get in touch, feel free to do so. I'm always happy to chat. Oh, another message I wanted to give: diversify ecology.
Ooh, that's a good one too.
yeah, we have so much to learn from different ways of knowing and different backgrounds. And I guess that kind of came up with the writing, but I think that's really important.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening to this 85th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at BBK_95, the podcast at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or an old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, freshwater ecosystems have intrinsic value and are in need of conservation and diversify ecology.